The Sunstone Theological Society presents this live recording from the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Initiations, priesthood, and phallus. My name is Jordan Kimball, and I'll be introducing Steve Rapp and Keith Thompson, who will be presenting, two presenters. Is this on?
No, I don't think it's on.
It's on, but I'm not speaking into it. Okay.
Change this
to the other.
Is this on?
We can. Okay. For the moment, I'll just speak into this and let Steve speak into that microphone.
You might want to maybe replace this.
Okay, this is Steve Rapp on your left, and he is an entrepreneur, president of the Stephen Rapp Film Project, and he develops scripts and moves them into the next process of being produced. And on your right is Keith Thompson, and he's a writer and video historian, and he's working on a book on the male initiation in our society and exploring that. And I'll now turn the time over to the two of them. After they've made the presentation, we'll have some time for questions to be asked.
I'd kind of like to begin with some disclosure here. I'm always a little nervous when there's a possibility of the assumption of some sort of academic credentials on the people that participate in these things, and having a great deal of respect for the academic credentials that have presented in other sessions, I would like to sort of divorce myself from that, because I did have a rather failed academic career, and more importantly, what I would like to present to you is going to come from the center of my experience. So I at least have something to talk about which I can substantiate. I'd like to, if I have the wherewithal to do so, to break the structure of the time down to where I will speak for 20 minutes from a personal point of view, and in that process, I will introduce Keith and how I came into contact with Keith and his work, and then turn the time over to Keith for another 20-25 minutes, which will leave a liberal, well, and then the two of us will comment upon each other if there's anything to comment on, and then we will try and leave a liberal amount of time for some questions and answers or elaborations. I think one of the major things that I've discovered about myself, a little too late for my own liking, was the intuitive, introverted nature of my personality growing up in a small Mormon Utah community. I grew up where soft behavior within Mormonism was encouraged. And being a sort of a loner, I spent a lot of my time in the mountains with my own mind and imagination, and did not grow up with a well-established sense of masculinity, but rather a well sense of my feminine side of my personality. I never wanted to hit anybody, I dabbled in vegetarianism, and I wanted to save the whales. All of the sort of good boy behavior. In fact, the idea of a good boy growing up in Utah to me was associated with sort of these gentle sort of expressions of manhood. What I would like to speak about is my crisis. I continued in this particular belief and behavior well into my 20s and into the 60s, where again the feminine side of the of masculinity was highly valued and highly acknowledged, particularly among women in the Bay Area where I was living at the time, and continued following through on that until I went through a marriage, a divorce, a remarriage to a profoundly strong woman with profoundly strong views of not only her behavior but what my behavior should be, and was sort of browbeaten into the position of being of a division of labor that was popular at that time in terms of my participation in the raising of children, housework, other sort of behavior that was making life at least peaceful. There was one predominant fact that kept reoccurring in my life, though, and that was I was very, very unhappy. Went through various forms of therapy until I finally came to the point where I realized that it was not an issue of me having problems. I had a problematic life, and indeed I had to go seek analysis. As fate would have it, I did fall into an analytic relationship with a Jungian analyst, and very early on in my self-discovery, I had a very important dream. I dreamt that I was in a field with my wife, and unexpectedly she began to have contractions to give birth. I was shocked because I had no idea she was pregnant, and the contractions were very violent and very frightening. Suddenly she squatted down and lifted her skirt and delivered a stillborn fetus. Even though I was shocked at the occurrence, I was deeply grieved at the death and began to go through a sense of mourning and pain, at which time my wife, in sort of disgust and anger, picked up the fetus and threw it as far as she could into a field. I was horrified and decided this fetus needs a proper burial. So I went to seek the fetus in the grasses. And I saw it, and as I approached it, I realized that already something was beginning to change. The fetus was no longer the way I had originally seen it, but in fact it had grown and was changing form. So I decided to get a stick and start to poke at it. And as I started to poke at it, it began to grow into frightening proportions and frightening dimensions, to the point where the fetus grew before my eyes into a very large, vicious serpent dragon, right out of Aliens. I mean, we're talking about saliva dripping off the fangs, and it faced me, and it was there in front of me. And for a moment, I had this realization that this serpent was going to strike me, and its intention was very clear. It was my utter destruction. And it was going to strike. I knew it was going to strike, and I had only one chance, and only one chance only, to save myself, and that was one well-timed blow to the head when it struck. So I sat there prepared, and the dragon reared back its head and struck, and I woke up. Two processes began after that dream in my life. One is I started working out on a heavy bag, learning how to punch. This was sort of a masculine sort of behavior, but I needed to internalize this dream, and I needed to know that that I had that particular energy, that I could throw a punch, because it was something foreign to me, it was something alien to me, and without that strength, my destruction was assured. The other was I began to explore probably the most lovely and wonderful experience of my life, and that is translating the mythic nature of the dream into my conscious life. I was amazed as I sat on the couch analyzing this dream of this dragon. You know, surely this dragon had appeared before in my childhood recollections of reading. Something stood in my mind of knights and dragons, and I thought, this is all rather silly, you know, come on, this is too cute. But I began to look at mythology as a source of understanding for some sort of healing. The process, part of my life, although I'm not academically inclined, I do have a passion for bibliotherapy, and I began a passionate sort of research in the area of male issues in relationship to mythology. I travel a lot to Los Angeles and went to one of the most esoteric bookstores I could. This is 5-6 years ago, and went to the bookseller and said, I'm looking for some books on male consciousness. And I got the blankest stare I've ever had in my life. It was a totally alien concept to this poor bookkeeper. And she was just stunned for a moment, and she said, well, let's go look. And we sort of walked through, you know, the racks and racks of books on female consciousness that arose in the 70s, 80s, political and otherwise. But there was nothing. There was nothing available to me. Finally, a little light went on. She said, oh, wait a second. I do know something. It's over here. And she pulled out a little book called He by Robert Johnson, which is examining male psychology using Parsifal and the Holy Grail as sort of a focus point. I learned something very important in that process right off the bat. The book spoke of, and I wished we could talk more about male mythology, and I wish we could talk more about fairy tales and the relationships to men, but early on, I discovered that Parsifal had what was called the Christ wound, and this was a wound in the side, and some earlier versions have the wound in the groin, connotating possibly some sort of sexual wounding, but the thing about it was a wound that would not heal. And there was nothing that I had read or come in contact with that had the psychic energy that sort of itemized my particular feeling at the time that there was a grief going on in my life that was associated with lack of masculine identity that would not heal. And much like Parsifal, one of the activities one can do to keep from hurting is place oneself in a lot of frenetic activity, business, sports, anything to keep your mind off the pain. Poet Robert Bly says that grief is the doorway into the male consciousness or unconsciousness. I felt like I was without a masculine identity. I felt that I had no idea, because I had no close relationship with my father, and because I was duly rewarded for the feminine component of my personality, that in fact I had not the slightest idea what constituted masculinity. This was a deep, you know, this was a deepening of the wound for me. I'd like to talk quickly and briefly and move through some material. I've been glad to see that there has been some emphasis on Jungian concepts in the symposium. I attended the Theology of the Soul seminar, and the word archetype is used commonly, and I sometimes feel that there may not be a clear definition for a lot of people of what an archetype is, so I'd like to give a definition of an archetype. This is a sort of a blending of several ideas of C.G. Jung. An archetype is a universally deep, initially unconscious pattern of behavior and psychic functioning that emerge in the psychic lives of particular individuals to aid in adaptation and growth during life crises. Well, I was in a crisis, there was no doubt about it, and there were several archetypes that were emerging in my analysis and in my theory that had very clear, strong, potential masculine power and energy behind it, but I still couldn't understand it. For many men, the dominance of masculinity is taken for granted. So familiar is their experience of superior status. But for an increasing number, masculinity is as much an enigma as femininity to men and to women. Every neurosis or crisis is connected with man's most intimate life. There will always be some hesitation when a man has to give a complete account of all the circumstances and complications which originally led him into this morbid condition. But why shouldn't he be able to talk free? Why should he be afraid, or shy, or prudish? The reason is that he is carefully observing certain external factors which form important constituents of what one calls public opinion, respectability, or reputation. I sort of encourage this panel from Lynn Whiteside's because I've been doctoring a belief that Mormon intellectualism is in grave danger of being overdetermined by Mormon feminism. This is due to, I think, an overt reaction to patriarchy. And unless masculinity is differentiated from patriarchy, both will go down the drain together. One of the most important dreams, I think, that Jung even refers to in his life is a dream, it was a daydream. He daydreamed that he visioned a church and all its glory and all its splendor, and as his attention went into the sky, into the glorious clouds where God was, he suddenly shut down. He couldn't allow himself for the daydream to continue. And this plagued him. It was a compulsive sort of fact in his life. Every time he looked up into the clouds, he just said, I can't go on with this daydream, I've got to move on. Well, as some of you know the dream, those of you who don't, eventually Jung was able to let go of this compulsion and allow the daydream to continue. And so the beautiful church was before him, the beautiful dome, the cathedral, the gold, the beautiful clouds, and out of the clouds drops a giant turd and shatters the church. In many ways, I think patriarchy represents the same aspect of that church. Patriarchy must be defined as a container, probably an outdated container, a worn container, a cracked container, incapable of holding new ideas of masculinity. One might think that in a patriarchal society, males would grasp the basis of masculinity, of masculine identity, naturally and spontaneously. They do not. Masculine identity does not come automatically. There is a process that can facilitate the growth of man and his identity. Another event that sort of occurred in my bibliotherapy is I became deeply interested in the issue of fathering. It was something that I could at least claim that I was halfway good at. It was what I was basing my identity on. If my career is failing, if the rest is falling, at least I can claim some sort of credibility as a father. And I think it's important that, you know, much attention has been paid to the hero as an archetype for men. Joseph Campbell has contributed greatly to that study, but there are other male archetypes that are equally important. One of them is the father. I did a great deal of research on the father, and at the end of a good year of reading everything I could get my hands on, I came to a staggering sort of revelation. These people who were trying to define father was defining fatherhood as men doing mothering behavior. And boy, this got me. This really got me. For one thing, it got me because I felt it was true, and the other thing, it raised a question in my mind. What is uniquely father that only man can do? After much discussion with my wife looking at life experiences with my family, we came to at least one concept of a father that only a father can do, and that is deliver the child from the sphere of the mother. Uh, In some ways, I've been toying with the idea that perhaps priesthood, which is the church. I'm not talking about people quitting the church and giving up their membership, but I'm talking about that psychic energy in the church that closely appropriates mother, the sort of containing element of holding the individual into a certain set of boundaries. And I'm looking, you know, I'm toying with this idea that perhaps one of the failings of priesthood is that has not been able to deliver the member from that psychic energy, from that sphere. I'm going to just relay a quick experience and introduce a couple of ideas. I know everybody, a lot of people are here because phallus is in the title, so I feel it's my... Two years ago, I attended an architectural panel at the Sunstone Symposium. I was sort of bored through most of it. I couldn't find anything to disagree with. Until the question and answer period came up, and there was some sort of talk about symbolism of the temples. And a young lady raised her hand and said, "Well, does anybody know what the symbolism of the spires on the temple were?" And somebody sort of, you know, with a great deal of assurance said, "Well, I think anybody who understands the basics of Freudian psychology will know what the spires on the temple represent." Well, I finally got nudged a little bit because of two immediate reactions. One was I thought there was a great deal of intellectual smugness on his part, having some sort of inside information into something I wasn't quite sure of. And the other was a seeming underlying implied disdain and ridicule for things phallic. I can understand this. I can understand there's been a great deal of pain from the, you know, from males towards women. Phallic can represent something that is painful, harmful. But I asked myself, I mean, what would these people prefer for a symbol? I mean, are we looking for fiddlehead ferns as a possibility of male energy? Or do we need to have a new respect for a once sacred symbol in society, the phallus? The phallus is sometimes taken to be a symbol of masculine dominance and power. It does not have to be seen this way. The male sex organ can be thought of as an instrument of fertility, and as a symbol of the connection between primal maleness and nurturance. The benevolent phallic image points to the truth that has been pushed away by the dominance of patriarchy, that the male as well as the female can be associated with the earth, the seed, growth, birth, and rebirth. The loss of male respect and male identity, for me personally, I consider to be a religious experience. The loss is somewhat associated with what Jung called the crushing of the soul. Everything that I held to be some sort of image of my own masculinity was taken from me and forced me into a reevaluation of what I was about and why I was suffering the way I did. I can identify at this point probably the most important aspect in my life is the failing of my father to initiate me into the sphere of manhood. As I look around the church, I have a great deal of fear for what I perceive to be sexual ambiguity among men. There's a great deal of reward for feminine behavior. There's a great deal of reward for feminism in men. I am likely to say I think the last thing on earth the church needs is more feminist men. The idea of male energy when in authority could be good has come to be considered impossible. Yet the Greeks understood and praised that energy. They called it Zeus energy, which encompasses intelligence, robust health, compassionate authority, intelligent, physically healthy authority, goodwill, leadership, in sum, positive power accepted by the male in the service of the community. I will now turn the time over to Keith, and Keith will present his paper on male initiation. After that, he and I will together sort of bounce some things off each other and then throw it to the audience.
Well, I was going to begin by asking, by acknowledging that we're trying to cover a lot of territory: masks, initiation, priesthood, and phallus. I was going to see how we should break the time down and ask who came to hear what. But there's the embarrassment factor, which is mostly my own, so I won't do that. As for credentials, formal credentials, I have a friend who has the initials NDW after his name, and I finally asked him what that meant, and he said it means no degree whatever. I am a writer in San Francisco, and I'm writing a book north of San Francisco. I'm writing a book on what I call the necessary challenge of male initiation and male rites of passage. And I want to say at the outset, just for your own frame of reference, that I'm not a Mormon, and I'm not going to use my time to draw the parallels that I might if I had, you know, an hour with you, spend a half an hour about my own thinking and then make some parallels. So I'll leave that up to you, and maybe in our discussion period we can get to that. I also want to say that I'm never particularly crazy about this format of delivery. You know, me standing up here, you out there. I'm going to deliver something that I wrote. I kept in mind that I'd be speaking it as I wrote it, and yet there's always that quality that what's on the written page, it's not, it's written, and I'm going to refer to my notes and hopefully not get attached to them too much. I'll begin by referring to a book by the anthropologist Arnold Van Gennep in 1960 called Rites of Passage. This became a classic book, and this book argued that rites of passage evolved in human society for the specific purpose of marking each individual's movement through particular life stages, marking transitions from one phase of life to another. He concluded that all rites of passage proceed through three stages: stage of separation, a stage of transition, and a stage of incorporation. Now, certain kinds of ceremonies, certain kinds of rites of passage emphasize one more than another, one of these stages. A funeral, for example, is a rite of passage marking a separation. An initiation ceremony, a male initiation ceremony marking a boy's passage to manhood, is primarily a ceremony of transition from one state to another. And a marriage is a ceremony that is primarily an act of union or incorporation, although a marriage also partakes of separation from your previous single state, previous parental identification. So, in effect, each rite of passage has some of each stage. Van Gennep argued further that rites of passage exemplify what he thought to be a fundamental law of life, essentially the law of regeneration, that the energy present in any system, any living system, will tend to dissipate. It's a kind of entropy. And so human beings devised and derived rites of passage for the specific purpose of regenerating life at specific stages. When initiation is a ritual of passage from each life stage to the next, then the living system of the individual is understood to be recharged as he or she moves to the next stage of life. Thus, the individual dies to his previous circumstances, which is a separation. He goes through some manner of initiation or transition, like going into the belly of the whale, moving through what St. John of the Cross called a dark night of the soul, some ambiguous, ambivalent, I'm not that anymore, but I'm not this anymore. And then finally, a third stage culminating in being born into the new, which is the incorporation. Today I want to address myself in the time that I have to the question of male initiation. That is, those stages of separation, transition, and incorporation which mark male life passages. I specify this because we could spend a lot of our time discussing the general stages of initiation and rites of passage in general, and we could talk about how different rites of passage differ for different groups, how male initiation is different from female initiation. There are similarities and there are differences. But I don't have that luxury in the time we have. So I'll begin. If, as I believe to be the case, rites of passage have a survival value for the species in general, and if they serve this regenerative function that Van Gennep argued they do, then the question that interests me is how the ancient task of male initiation is being met in today's culture. How are men today regenerating themselves as men? Male initiation ceremonies traditionally, in primitive and so-called traditional cultures, have served many functions. Rites of passage for men have served to link the individual male to the group at critical times of his life passage, and likewise served to link the group to the individual. They have served to heighten the individual male's consciousness of the transformations he's going through in his life. An example being the passage from boyhood to manhood, being an essential transition, and a man did not make this passage by himself. He made it in the company of other men. And so that was one of the functions of traditional male initiation. Also specifically to mark, in general, throughout a lifetime, movement from one life stage to another. Initiation ceremonies and rites of passage have serve to give men courage to move on in life, to take new steps, to avoid skipping stages and to avoid misfiring, from skipping a stage and somehow missing something important. So my question today is, how are these needs being met today for men? I would say that largely this work is not being done. At least it's not being done directly. It's being done haphazardly for the most part. And that I believe this absence reflects the larger absence of rites of passage in our culture in general. Certainly the popularity of the recent public broadcasting system series of conversations between the mythologist Joseph Campbell and Bill Moyers marks this hunger, I believe, for an awareness of the mythological dimension of life and what is its relationship to day-to-day life. Rites of passage have traditionally served to do this for human beings. I don't know how many of you have been able to catch any of those conversations with Joseph Campbell. Specifically, these ceremonies in male initiation have marked what it means to be a man in a larger context of what it means to be a human. Let's look briefly to set the context further. What are the traditional characteristics of male initiation in the primitive traditional cultures? Number one, the boys are separated from the women for a specific ritual ceremonial purpose. Number two, they are subjected to ordeals and trials of endurance by the older men. Number three, they are instructed in tribal lore, myths, and traditions and legends, where we came from as a people, who we are in a sacred historical sense, the effect of which is to make it impossible for the boy to ever, quote, go home again to the pre-initiated way of being. He's leaving the realm of childhood in a ritual, symbolic, specific way. It's not left to accident, it's not left to television, it's not left just to hanging out with his friends, although it happens in that, you know, men get together as men, but it was understood to happen in this ritual ceremonial way. Number four, the boys in these ceremonies are ritually slain, symbolically slain and brought back to life, which is again a symbolic statement of the need to die to childhood and be reborn to adult male development. And that is understood to be an essential ritual act. It's a second birth, is what male initiation has traditionally provided. And number five, finally, all of this is done in the name of the gods or tradition. That is to say, it is a context or a container setting a man's sights for the first time in his life, probably, on the question, what is my relationship to the entire cosmos? What is my purpose for being alive? What is my business as a man? What is the universe and what's my place in it? That's what male initiation ceremonies have provided. Now I want to ask the question, how is this, well I've asked, how is it not being done? I believe largely it's not being done, at least in that ritual ceremonial way. I want to ask why it's not being done. And here I want to echo something Stephen said, and that is partly it's a failure of our educational system. When Patricia Sexton, a writer who has dealt with this theme, has argued that the increasing employment of women as teachers to instruct and discipline young boys results in the production of feminized males. Female-dominated educational systems of the past several hundred years, especially since the Industrial Revolution, contribute rather effectively to breaking the mold, breaking the archetype, if you will, of male initiation. Feminine, quote-unquote, rather than masculine, quote-unquote, whatever we agree or disagree on those to be, but feminine rather than masculine characteristics are rewarded in girls as well as boys. It's not that there's a problem with feminine qualities. There would be a problem with one emphasized over the other. I think in the past 20 years of feminism, especially the past 10 years of feminism, many women have come to see also there's a real problem with entering the traditional male workforce, especially when they enter the corporate executive world, which is entirely masculine determined, or almost entirely masculine determined. There's no place to hold on to traditional feminine or feminine characteristics. It's very difficult. Likewise, with men being taught primarily by female teachers, there's a reward for feminized behavior. In any case, it's hardly a wonder in our time that so many males, young males, choose to drop out of school altogether and enter a kind of marginal life in which their aggressive male spirit is challenged in the way that traditional male initiation ceremonies saw to being done. That was one of the functions of male initiation, to validate that aggressive side, not to give it priority so that it's acted out in the world, but primarily so that it's incorporated in the psyche, given a place. When this work isn't done, men have to find outlets that often are destructive when we don't have male initiation ceremonies. In effect, they seek to initiate themselves. They join motorcycle clubs, punk rock associations. They join street gangs. If any of you have seen the film Colors, it's a particularly graphic and in many, some ways, extreme statement of what goes on in Los Angeles street gangs, most of which are young minority men in this culture who have no contact with their fathers. They come from single family households, which, as most of you know, is a polite euphemism for dad is not here anymore. We don't know who our father is. Mom is holding down two, maybe three jobs or on welfare. That's what the single family household means. And when young men are raised in that environment, as well as young women, but particularly I'm focusing on the psychic damage of young men. A good many psychologists in recent years have bemoaned the abundant supply of Peter Pan males. We've heard a lot of books, we've seen a lot of books about the puer eternus, the eternal boy who won't, can't grow up. He won't keep his commitment to women and children, especially his own. And again, the rise of the single family household headed by mothers is additional evidence of this. Well, to me, the amazing fact, what I'm working on in my book, is not this phenomenon in itself, but our surprise over it, or our supposed surprise over this fact. How could it be otherwise, considering these conditions that I'm referring to? Anthony Stevens, a Jungian psychotherapist, puts it this way, quote, "Instead of producing mature males inspired with the common ideals of the community, our educational system is loosing upon the whole world generations of morally and sexually ambivalent tricksters." Now, by tricksters, he defines a trickster as that person, that sort of trickster is a character in mythological figures, as many of you may know, especially in Native American mythologies. When the trickster shows up in a person's life exclusively, it's a person who knows no difference between right and wrong, who's been taught no difference between right and wrong, makes no distinction, and has no discipline in his life other than his own experimental attitude to life. I'll simply find out by living. And when male initiation doesn't happen for young men, that is often the direction a young man will go. Is it unfair to blame, to lay the blame entirely on the educational structure of our country? Certainly it is. I think it's more that the elders in our culture have lost faith in the values to which they are custodians. Elder men in particular no longer seem to possess knowledge as to what it is manhood is about, what it means to be a boy, what it means, what boys should be initiated into or initiated for. In many cases, they themselves, the elder males of our culture, received no initiation from their fathers, nor they from theirs. Again, the response to Joseph Campbell's vision, I think, is some evidence of this hunger for a new sense of confidence in what we are about as a culture. And I think the culture at large has lost a sense of confidence in its values. When male initiation is absent, the boy persists in clinging to mother, not only the personal but the archetypal mother. There's a kind of magnetic force that thwarts male spirit and development. This is not that the mother is doing anything wrong. but that this traditional role of the male is to help the young man be delivered out of that role exclusively. And as I talk about this theme to women, most of them are in the audience saying yes, especially women who are raising their children by themselves. They know, and when I say, especially male children, they know that they can't handle it. It's too much. It was never done in history before. Women were never expected to have hulking 14, 15, 16-year-old boys around the house. It's impossible. Women know that they can't initiate, and they don't like feeling like a failure because it cannot be done. So the question of when a young man lacks that kind of initiation in his life, he will tend to fall prey to fantasies of achievement and conquest. He will seek to attain high deeds, such as climbing Mount Everest, as an externalization of this deep desire to conquer something fierce in his inner life. Again, to submit one to ritual requires first that a ritual be provided. Is this happening for young men in our culture today? TV adventure dramas give ample evidence of the need to stand trials and ordeals. But what is usually missing, beside the fact that it's mostly a spectator sport and you cannot become initiated as a male or a female by watching television, you become initiated into more television. But primarily what's missing is the cultural follow-through in these trials that we see on television. The sacral confirmation of the ordeal, that is to say, a recognition of the meaning of the sacrifice that is required. That is what happened in male initiation ceremonies. There was a sense that this ordeal meant something. You were becoming a man, and that meant something. Now, whether it's Kojak or Hill Street Blues, we often don't get the completion of that cycle, and so it's left unformed, and young men move into the streets in street gangs, and if not that exaggerated, if not that extreme, they end up in a marginal place in their lives. Let me again cite Anthony Stevens about the essential truth of male initiation rites. Primarily, it is an experiential reality. He defines it this way. Stage one, now I am a boy belonging to my mother. Now I am a boy leaving my mother and submitting myself to the rituals that the male gods have decreed. Now I die as a boy. Now I am born as a man among men. That would be a synopsis of those stages that a traditional male initiation ceremony provides. That could last, by the way, for 30 days or longer. Different cultures, different tribes have a gradation of events. A man cannot do this work of initiation by simply distancing himself from other men. It cannot be done that way. Perhaps rejecting the traditional male stereotype in a culture is satisfying to a man, but that is not the same as male initiation. And a man cannot be initiated by attempting to win favor with separatist feminists or those who are criticizing traditional male values. A man then ends up in what I call no man's land. He's lost any kind of fruitful contact with other men in his life, and he's also this kind of source or target of derision by feminists who, on an unconscious level, at least recognize that there needs to be some fierceness in a man. Fierceness is not the same as savagery, but most feminists recognize that a man needs a certain fierceness. And when a man abdicates that and seeks favor among feminists, and I particularly mean separatist radical feminist ideologists, then a man is really left no place. Let me begin the conclusion by arguing that we are in some way wired for initiation. Whether it's in California or New York or Salt Lake City, men are beginning, whether it's on the model of the therapy talking group. Any way men get together to explore their wounds is important, and that work is beginning to happen. I think I've said now, in conclusion, three times. I think I'll add it one more time. I've got my watch, so I know I'm in safe time. One of the main complaints of men today is they're losing power to women. And there's no difficulty men have in pointing to evidence in behalf of this feeling, the feminist movement and so forth, has left men, many men, with a strong sense of losing power to women. And indeed, the political, social, and cultural world in which we live, this late 20th century, is a very difficult world for men and women. Life is changing, and with it, the male-female balance of power. But beyond these outer issues of political power, I want to propose that there's a sense in which men as a whole are not losing power to women at all. What's instead happening is that women are instead taking back the energy and the power that they previously used to support and express men's feeling sides for them, to carry that for them. Women, according to all the signs around us, simply aren't willing to do that anymore. They are not willing, have you noticed? They're not willing to carry men's feeling sides. They're not willing to carry their emotional sides and take care of that for them, except perhaps women in various fundamentalist traditions who know that carrying everything for men, feeling luggage, is what God wants them to do. But in most cases, that's outside fundamentalist groups. As a result, we men feel more uncertainty, depression, usually, feelings of dependence that make us very uncomfortable, feelings of isolation and despair, and we assume it means a loss of power. We experience it that way, indeed. But I say, perhaps these feelings have been there all along, and we've lost the container that we used to have, which is that our women would hold these for us. We're uncertain now, many of us, whether we want to carry our own feelings and experience our own emotional life, now that women are too busy to developing their own inner lives to handle ours for us. And we are uncomfortable with the recognition that these difficult states and experiences and feelings actually belong to us. That, I want to submit, is really the fundamental work now of initiation. I think men have to initiate one another, and they have to initiate their own sons, to recognize that those dark feelings are part of the human and the male condition, and that there is, as the ancients always understood, there is gold in that darkness. If you heard Tom Moore yesterday in the plenary session, there is gold in the shadow we don't recognize. There's gold in that which we cast off. There is now a chance to recognize that there is richness in those feelings of despair and darkness in the male experience. And I think that we need to begin to do that work. And it's work that our own fathers never taught us, in most cases. Our fathers and mothers never really taught us that there was richness in our own psychic darkness, largely because they never learned or considered the fact that there was richness in their own psychic darkness, their own dark, uncertain states. And an example of this recently there's a sense in which we as men equate vulnerability with danger. And that is one of the fundamental tasks of initiation, is to work with that issue. We might have gone for psychological counseling because at critical life stages, the death of his brother and the defeat in the governorship in the late 70s, he wasn't feeling very good. He's feeling some difficulty. The very thought that he would seek help and seek counseling has caused tremendous controversy. So I want to propose that is much of the work of male initiation, and I'll bring this to a close now. Stephen and I can talk a little bit, and then we can take questions.
One thing that Keith and I have not had a lot of time to talk about, although we've kicked around a lot of things. Here, Keith, why don't you take this so we can banter. I think within Mormonism, I really believe that Mormonism is based on archetypal principles that have slowly been, through either by choice, a close friend of mine, Paul Larson, in response to a paper on the first day, mentioned the fact that part of our problem is we have chosen to throw off, or through disobedience or sin or whatever you want to call it, some of the archetypal aids that we had in our life. And I think one of those is the priesthood. As I examine priesthood as it functions at the ward level, you know, just the simple thing, the baptism and ordination of an 8-year-old boy has lost all psychic energy, as far as I can tell. There's almost an embarrassment about it. The preparation leading up to it is somewhat trivialized, and the idea is to get it over with and move on with it and place as little emphasis on it as we possibly can, along with all the other ordinations and advancements within a male. Mormonism's equivalent to the lodge has lost its energy. There's a shell, there's a structure, but it doesn't have, I think, the energy that could be applied to it. The other thing, I think, is the integration of the elders of the church into hierarchies of power and sort of being pushed up out of the mainstream of the church. My wife has a very strong opinion, that, having just taught primary, that primary should be the function of the high priests. The teaching of small children, primarily their abilities as storytellers, and I think their ability to enrapture and enchant, and also there's a certain sort of dynamic that goes on with a young child and an old man that is missed in our society that could be taken advantage of. The other thing is this issue of the male shadow. I think religion traditionally stands at the door of the shadow and says, do not go in. There is no telling what will happen to you if you go in. You may emerge some sort of demonic character who is going to rape, pillage, and murder everything in its sight. This fear of shadow that is created by religion, and particularly Mormonism. Mormonism doesn't like anything dark. Most religions don't. They want things to be up and light and airy and sort of McDonald's approach to it all. The idea of encouraging exploration of, say, for the male, you know, how many women are willing to encourage men to explore deeply their own sexuality and acknowledge and admit tendencies towards polygamy, tendencies toward monogamy, to acknowledge and admit a certain sort of fierce, aggressive type of personality. Only in not acknowledging those issues is there danger that they will be manifest in a violent and harmful way. And the one thing that Keith, I think we need to go on, and I'd like you to go on some more talking about, is this concept of male association without the interference of women. The whole idea of women demanding priesthood participation to me is fine. I have no problem with that at all, as long as I have an option to take men that I want to be intimate with and I want to be close with and explore masculine issues without the condemnation and interference of women is one of, I think, the most important issues for men, particularly Mormon men, who are so lacking in intimate male experiences. And, there aren't too many women I can sit around with and say, listen, I've got these deep-rooted polygamous inclinations, and I can bring that up with a man, and he's just saying, oh, God, I know, and it's a... It's not that there's always the fear and there's always the threat that talking somehow legitimizes, but I haven't found that to be the case in my life. But anyway, there's just a couple of responses I have. The other one is just one more quick quote by Jung. New points of view are as a rule discovered in territory, are not discovered as a rule in territory that is already known, but in out-of-the-way places that may be avoided because of their bad name. I think there's been a lot of avoidance of these particular issues about men because patriarchy has a bad name, and well, it should. I think patriarchy has done a pretty horrible job of it so far, but at the same time I want to reiterate, I think it's very important that women start, as well as men for themselves, start making the distinction between patriarchy and masculinity.
Well, I agree with much of what you said. I mean, the particular points that come to mind are the need, I'll give an anecdote, give a story. A mother in Illinois had two children, and she and her husband, he traditionally went away for a business trip to a convention every year, and he traditionally they went together. He said, why don't you come with me? I think it was out in California or someplace. And one year, he decided to take, or it was agreed that, gee, why don't you take Jim instead this year, the oldest son? Now, this came about partly, it was at her suggestion, which is very interesting. She'd begun, the kids were a little older, and she'd begun to take courses in psychology and joined a women's group and begun to keep a journal and had begun for the first time in her life to have time to write and pay attention to her own psychic life, to tend her own psychic garden. And so she had a little more, some stuff brewing in her psyche. There was certain richness. And she knew it was time. She says, why don't you take Jim with you this year? So he did. And the next year, he took the two boys, Jim and Steve, let's say. When they came home that year from the conference, the youngest son came into the kitchen, and mom was, washing the dishes, had her hands in the sink, or let's say, had her back to the rest of the kitchen. The little one came up and hugged her and said, Mommy, I hope it's okay. I still love you too, indicating I've gone away with Dad. And she told the story that what happened in her that moment was this fierce physical impulse to throw the son back, to recognize that there was to urge him to get that there was absolutely nothing wrong with him spending time with his father. It was absolutely crucial in a way that she could not have recognized before she had done her own letting go through her psychic work. She didn't love her son any less, but she recognized that it was crucial not only for the son's development to be with the father, but it was also crucial to hers, because she didn't... There was a certain stage that she'd gone through with her son, and he didn't need her, and she didn't need him in quite the same psychological ways. They needed each other in new ways, let's say. The relationship wasn't over. So that is an example of one that seems crucial about this issue of men needing time together with other men, especially, I think, younger and older men. This does not mean, as Steve indicated, that men and women need to talk less. Certain many of you agreed men and women need to learn to talk more, maybe need to learn to talk at all. But it does mean that men need to learn to talk, if not to women less, more to themselves. And I think we need to talk about things other than football, other than software. We need to talk about where we feel failed in our lives, not to wallow in it. I'm not advocating that we all become existentialists like Sartre and sort of, frame our despair at that level, or, quote, wimp-like, like Woody Allen's character that he plays. But nevertheless, the ability to bring into our lives our own wounds so that we don't project those onto women. I've heard a rumor that women are not crazy about constantly having to hear where their men are wounded or pick it up secondarily. Women I talk to are glad when men get together. Women who have some sense of security in their own psyche are pleased when men get together and do some of that work together, share their wounds together, and develop that richness, because a man inevitably is richer psychically when he comes back to the relationship with a woman. Let's say when he comes back from the Elks Club, whether the Elks Club is the literal place, and I don't want to idealize what goes on at Elks Clubs. They're usually not therapy sessions, but they, on a level, they are therapy sessions. And that is what goes on in lodges, is men ask the age-old question, who are these creatures called women? And there needs to be a place men ask about that and deal with it as men. Otherwise, if they don't ask about it, they will act out this weird question, who are these women, in their relationships with women. So
yeah, and also, I wanted to bring to the attention, I've failed to do this so far. The reason I sought out Keith originally years ago is Keith did an interview with the poet Robert Bly that was published in New Age magazine called What Men Really Want, along with the book He at that time. How long ago was that?
6 years ago.
Six years ago, yes, when I first got it. It's a staggering interview with Bly, and Bly, I think, coming back to this male association, tells a wonderful story of initiation of a boy in Africa, where the boy is suddenly plucked from the realm of the mother, probably in the middle of the night, unsuspecting, taken to a place of men. A frightening time for him, because he knows this is a time of dying, where and there's this wonderful ritual where the men in a circle each take a knife and slice their arm, and one at a time a bowl is passed in which blood is placed into the bowl of all the men in the circle. And when the bowl is through the circle, The bowl of blood is then given to the boy, and the boy, in love and kindness and in generosity, is asked to drink. Now, what that indicates and what that says and the psychic power behind that sort of ritual is the fact that there is nourishment in the blood of men, and that also there can be a separation for the blood of men to replace the milk of the mother. And, you know, I think it's a beautiful ritual, and, you know, unless you've got something else, you know, let's throw it out.
Well, one of the things that's one of the things that's understood in that drinking of the blood is that the boys are told, this is the blood, this blood from my arm is the blood that flowed from the ancestors. So there's that very physical blood sense of you are part of the lineage of men in our tradition, and don't ever forget it. You have a purpose for being here. Anyway.
Okay. Well, why don't we just... Should we pick a number? Take you... Yeah. That's why I asked you to first.
I really agree with what these men say.
Well, I think... First of all, we have to acknowledge there are many men who do not want to associate themselves with patriarchy. I have no interest in associating myself with patriarchy. I couldn't get away with it for a minute, to be quite frank. Not in my home. How to separate patriarchy and men? And, well, I think you have to see patriarchy as the container. Much like the container that was shattered by the turd from the clouds. I think that, you know, the shattering of the patriarchal container is taking place. I think it is not serving its purpose any longer. It cannot endure too much longer under the attack that it's under, which is fine with me. I won't mourn its passing at all. You know, the Hopis have a great reverence for containers. The pot has great, the container, the pot has great spiritual value in that it holds the liquid, it holds the grain, it holds the energy, it contains sacred life forces of water and grains and those types of things. When a pot has lost its usefulness and the pot is destroyed, the pot is broken. But one shard is always taken and reground into the new mixture of the clay. I think the thing that needs to be preserved in patriarchy is the male association, the private male association. And masculinity is the liquid, the grain, the energy into which whatever the new container is, I prefer the archetype, the lodge, because it has more poetics for me, you know, just a place. I mean, one of the most wonderful times in my life was when I sort of developed an ad hoc boxing club with some close friends of mine, and, you know, Friday night was sort of a sacred time. It, you know, as we got real down and dirty, and, you know, it was like, you know, we cheered the victories and, you know, argued the decisions, and it was... There was something that I had never... I had not been allowed that expression in my life. There was something... There's something, you know, a little dangerous about that kind of association.
I don't really have an answer to it, except I think it's the right... It's a very right question. And I'd like... If anyone wants to comment on that, how do we do... What's the work involved there? I'd like to open up and get...
The man next.
I think that the
primarily because it's a new definition. You know, we're seeking a new definition. You know, I've given it a lot of thought, and the only thing I can come up with right now, as I've mentioned, is the one thing that a man can do that a woman can't do is initiate another man.
We may have fouled up our definition.
No, I claim that as masculine. I think I drew the comparison on the phallus, the nurturance. The earth relationship, you know, I think that man has those things too, but there's also, you know, it's, how do you say it? You know, it's indefensible and irresistible, the certain things of manhood or masculinity that have bad names. I mean, there are certain, you know, is there something inherently wrong with aggression?
No. I'm not sure it's inherently male. Yeah.
No, well, you know, then you get into typology, you know, into definitions of, you know, I'm a male because I have a majority of male genes. I don't know if that's a majority of one or a majority of 20, but somehow or another the decision was, you know, the line was crossed and I was thrown into the world with masculine identity. You know, that means I still have a very predominant feminine component. I think the danger comes when that becomes where all the work is. You know, I've got to work on this kind of posture that I'm going to take in the world, and I've, you know, for the roll of the dice, I'm here as a man.
Well, yeah, and just a brief comment on that, and that I like to make a distinction between male and female on the one hand, which I consider biological. You know, there are a certain number of males in this room and a certain number of females. And then the other distinction is, you know, masculine, feminine, which are psychological qualities. And that's where the problem is, it seems to me. And that is a woman who goes out and decides she knows what she wants to do in this world and pursues it, is she in her masculine side when she does that? There's a certain kind of colloquial idea that, yes, she is. What's the language? You know, an assertive woman is a bitch, in terms of the double bind that women face. When a man is assertive and goes after what he wants, he's determined. A woman who does that is a castrating bitch, let's say. Likewise, when a man is in his feeling side, oh, he's in his feminine side. That's the stereotype. I propose there's probably a male mode of feeling, and that's what happens when men get together, not just talk about football and software, but when they talk about where they are and what they feel. We often think feeling is feminine, but again, that's that over-determining. We let women have to carry all the feeling. So when a man's in his feminine feeling side, he's in his feminine side. So if we could start to rattle some of these, a man can be masculine and in his masculinity when he's in his feelings. And there's a certain kind of feminine assertiveness or female assertiveness that is not masculine, perhaps. And anyone in particular who disagrees with any of this, I'd like to flesh that up so we could...
You want to follow up?
I think what we're doing is we're emphasizing the differences as somewhat secondary.
Well, I don't think the bringing back can take place. I think Jung, in the last part of his life, determined that alchemy represented symbolically the life process of becoming whole. Alchemists, as you know, were projecting psychological ideas onto conscious processes of changing base material into gold. And there was a whole number of processes that have great psychological significance. One of the first processes before you can change base material to gold is a process called separatio. That is where you go in through the process of refiner's fire, where it is reduced either by, you reduce it in its own liquid or you burn it. You break the elements down into its separate pieces as a precursor of, in a later process, bringing them back into the gold. I think part of the process that has to take place is that separation. I think you need to separate the masculine, separate the feminine, and make sure you know clearly what they are before you bring them back together for the final process, which actually, symbolically, I think has a great deal of significance in terms of temple ordinances. It's conjunctio. It's man and woman in the act of sexuality. And so the symbolic connection of the two. But before that takes place, has to be separated. And part of initiation, the first part of initiation, is separation.